So I'd like to talk in particular about how the dust and to some extent the gas move around within protostellar disks during planet formation. And the reason that's interesting is that we like to be able to exchange material between hot and cold regions to explain some chemical and mineral disequilibrium properties in protostellar disks and also in planetary systems afterwards. And some of the ideas in here are quite preliminary, so I welcome your suggestions and questions. So here are four examples of protostellar disks that are seen more or less edge-on. And we see them because the dust in their atmospheres scatters some of the starlight towards our line of sight. But these images are have pixel sizes of 10 AU or more, so we don't of course see what's going on in very close to the star.
That's a big help. Thank you. Now we can see the screen. We can't see Neil, but we can see the screen.
That's good. Okay, that's important.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I need it for it, sorry.
So although we can't see directly, we can't resolve what's happening at 1 AU, we can get some information from spectra. And so here's a whole collection of Spitzer mid-infrared spectra from Furlan et al. And in a bunch of objects, there's a big, strong 10 micron silicate band telling us that there's submicron-sized silicate grains in the disk atmosphere where the temperature is near, so the black body peaks at 10 microns, so a few hundred degrees, so that means AU distances. That's where we're probing. But on the other hand, there are plenty of other sources where there is not a feature like that. So there are not submicron crystalline grains, or in some cases even not submicron amorphous grains in the disk atmosphere. And it doesn't seem to be related to the age of the source to the extent that we can measure the ages. So there must be some other parameter in there. What is it that also affects the properties of the dust? Another reason that we care about the transport of material between the hot inner and cold outer parts is because comets, which of course formed where there was ice, so below say 150 degrees, also contain crystalline grains like this one brought back by the Stardust mission. And in order to become crystalline, they had to be heated up to about 1,000 degrees or so, and temperatures like that were found only well inside the ice line. So the logical way to make comets with this combination of materials in them is through some kind of radial mixing. So here's an outline of the talk, so four steps to the argument. First, looking at ionization processes, and stellar X-rays are the most effective ones. And then on the other hand, looking at the recombination, and that happens mostly on the grain surfaces if they have even a small fraction of the abundance that they have in the interstellar medium. And then where the ionization is enough to couple the magnetic fields to the gas, the magnetic forces produce turbulence, and that happens in the atmosphere since that's where the X-rays from the star are absorbed. And then I'll discuss some arguments for why you get flows in the radial direction at about the sound speed in the disk atmosphere, where you do have this coupling of the magnetic fields to the gas, and then talk about how that will allow you to perhaps carry grains over a long distance in radius. So first, the ionization and recombination processes. So here is Chandra X-ray image of the Orion Nebula cluster, and basically everything that is an infrared source and a young star is also detected in the X-rays. And in many cases the X-ray luminosity is a bigger fraction of the bolometric luminosity than for the Sun. So it's almost a given that for a young star there are going to be X-rays emitted into its surroundings. And presumably it's by processes similar to what happens on the Sun, like here. There's magnetic reconnection that produces energetic particles, and those then lead to X-ray emission. Here are the X-rays compared with some other ionization processes. So this is the ionization rate per per atom per second as a function of the column as you descend into the disk from above down to the midplane at 1 AU in the minimum mass nebula. And here's from these people's Monte Carlo transport calculation of the X-rays. So they are absorbed in about the top 10 to the 25 particles, so about 10 grams per square centimeter. And the interstellar cosmic rays are a bit more penetrating, although at a much lower flux at the disk surface. And they start to fall off when you get down to about 100 grams per square centimeter. And then if you have, and then when you get right down to the midplane, there's radionuclides. If it's long-lived, like 10 to the 8 year, things like potassium 40, they don't even compete with the cosmic rays. But if you have aluminum 26, as some people think you did in the early solar nebula, then those become the main ionization processes very near the midplane. But as we'll see, you need to get up to rates like this to compete with the recombination on dust grains and get good coupling. So that means that the X-rays are what we care about the most. So here is here's the resulting dead zone. So this comes from solving for the ionization recombination balance. And most of the recombination happens on grains. And here I've assumed that we have a 1% mass fraction of 1 micron grains. And then the blue area is the area where we don't have enough coupling of the magnetic fields to the gas for turbulence. So this is the dead zone. And then to see just where the dead zone is, you notice that it goes out a bit past the orbit of Saturn here for these sort of fiducial parameters. And then the black lines and the gray shading here are at columns as you look down on the disk from above of 1, 10, and 100 grams per square centimeter. So the dead zone ends at about 10, which is about where the X-rays are absorbed. So it's the X-rays that are setting the size of the dead zone here.
And the reason, I guess the answer is no. I was going to say the reason why the other regions are ionized is because the whole density drops below 10, but that's not quite the case.
That is a big part of it, but also the volume density is lower, and so recombination becomes slower. If you go far enough out, then so this is just looking at the criterion based on the ohmic resistivity. If you go far enough out, then ampolar diffusion will become important too, and you'll have a different kind of dead zone out here as well. So now on to what happens if you do have good coupling, since we've shown that that's what you get, at least in the atmosphere. And this will be old news to some of you, but perhaps not to all of you. So this is how the magnetorotational instability works. So its importance was pointed out by Balbus and Hawley almost 20 years ago. So the young star is off to the left here. The green things are two blobs of gas within the disk seen in cross-section. So the rotation axis of the system is like this. And the X's get smaller as you go away from the star, showing orbital speed decreasing with radius. So the two blobs are threaded by a common magnetic field line in red. And you can see that the upper blob is nearer to the star, so it'll be orbiting faster. So relative to the midline of the magnetic field, it'll be pulling ahead into the screen. And the bottom one is orbiting slower because it's further from the star, so it'll be lagging behind. So relative to the midline, it'll be coming out towards us. So that means over time we're getting a bigger and bigger bend in the magnetic field along the direction of the orbit. That means a magnetic tension force. And the tension force, since this one is pulling forwards, the field is curved like this up here. So that tension force will be pulling it backwards. So it loses orbital angular momentum. So it'll spiral towards the star. This one down here has a magnetic field around it curved like this. And so it's going to be pulled forward in its orbit, and it'll gain orbital angular momentum, and it'll spiral away from the star. So an initially small wiggle in the field line like this will expand radially over time, and this runs away, and that's why it's an instability. And perhaps not too surprisingly, the wavelength of wiggle on the field line that grows fastest is roughly the signal propagation speed, which is the Alfvén speed, times the shear time scale, which is the orbital frequency, so the time scale for moving things apart once they're separated in radius. And so another way to think about that is to imagine that you make very short wavelength wiggles on the magnetic field, and then the tension force will be so strong that you force co-rotation, and so then there'll be no growth, there'll be no separation in radius. Or if you make some very long wavelength wiggle longer than the size of the screen here, for example, then the tension force will be weak and you'll get growth, but it'll be slow. And this wavelength in between is where the growth is fastest. So, and then here's a movie showing the consequences, linear growth and then developing into turbulence, that instability. So here we're looking at a little patch of the disk in a co-rotating frame. Star is off to the lower left here. And I've cut away one corner of the domain so we can see what's happening inside. So because we're in a co-rotating frame, stuff on the side nearer the star is orbiting faster, so we see it moving that way. We can't see the back, but stuff on the other side, because it's orbiting slower than the center of the domain, is going to be sliding the other direction. And we're looking at colors here, showing the kinematic viscosity. So where the color, on a logarithmic scale, so where the color is strong and red, that means angular momentum is being carried away from the star so that material can accrete towards the star. And blue is the reverse, so it's going the wrong way for accretion. And the movie lasted about 10 orbits, and I think so we can play it again.
These are like Reynolds and Maxwell stresses?
This is the Maxwell stress, the magnetic stresses. So, but then divided by the shear rate and the density to get a kinematic viscosity. And it's a log scale, so that means that you have much larger Maxwell stresses in the outer layers. And also notice, so this is an ideal MHD calculation, so we get turbulence throughout. But the scale of the turbulence down here near the midplane is small, and up here it's bigger. You get relatively big features, and that's because of that wavelength that we saw in the last slide, where the Alfvén speed is large in the disk atmosphere, you get big eddies. So another way to think of that is the magnetic field out there is stiff. Large Alfvén speed means a stiff field, and so in order to bend the field, you have to bend it over a relatively large radii of curvature. So these properties will prove to be important throughout the talk.
How many scale heights?
This goes, I think, 4 scale heights either side of midplane. So then that was ideal MHD. Now we can put in the resistivity, which is capable of switching off the instability and preventing turbulence where the resistivity is big enough. So for much of the rest of the talk, I'll be discussing calculations like this of a little patch of disk in the local rotating frame with an ohmic resistivity that varies along with the ionization fraction. And we have X-rays coming into the box from above and below and absorbed according to that Monte Carlo transport calculation. And then grains that are initially well mixed but then are able to settle towards the midplane. And the abundance of the grains determines the reaction rates for the recombination. So the ionization profile varies over time. And here's one of the results from one of those calculations. So now we're looking at the component of the magnetic field directed along the orbit. And you can see a big, this is the dead zone, this region in the middle. So it's not field free. I mean, you have sort of, the color is about like there, so we have about a tenth of a gauss, but it's relatively smooth throughout. And it's not tangled, it's not turbulent down in there, but it's field that's diffused in from the active layers above and below and also generated internally by shear. So although we have enough resistivity to shut off the MRI, which operates on relatively small scales in the interior, we don't have enough resistivity to prevent the winding up of the magnetic field over the scale of the radius, the distance to the star. So we do still get some field down inside. But then up in the active layers above and below, we get field that's tangled on much smaller length scales, and we get turbulence.
Can you tell us what's the scale of your azimuthal direction relative to the full circumference?
It's a small fraction, maybe 10% or 6%, something like that.
So are you worried that, I mean, when you look at global simulations of the MRI, you usually see power on all scales.
Yes.
So it's the loss, you're clearly losing the largest scales, right? So do we worry about that or not?
Yes, somewhat. So what happens as you go up here is that the magnetic pressure becomes much larger than the gas pressure. And the linear magnetorotational instability anyway, under those conditions, grows more slowly. The growth rate goes asymptotically to zero as the plasma beta goes to zero. And so the hope is that at least that instability won't be important when you go very far up. So there are spatial scales that we're not capturing. There is magnetorotation instability on those scales, but its growth rate is low, lower than in the part of the box where the wavelength fits into the box. I mean, there could certainly be things like loops that extend from one radius to another, and we're not capturing those. So yes, there could certainly be other things in here that are not included in these calculations. For example, it's known from the shearing box results that the strength of the turbulence depends on how much magnetic flux threads the patch of disk locally, and that could depend on the evolution of loops bigger than will fit into the boxes.
So are these net flux or zero net flux?
The earlier ones were zero net flux. This one has a small net flux, like a few milligauss or something. So, and notice that the layer that's active here and turbulent is one or two scale heights thick before you get up into the regime where the plasma beta is very small and the growth is slow. So now on to the third step in the argument, which is that we should expect to get channel flows in this active layer. So as you go up and up, the gas density drops off quickly, the magnetic pressure drops off less quickly. So the Alphane speed rises with height, and eventually the magnetic pressure exceeds the gas pressure. And so the size of the eddies is going to be about the same as the density scale height. So to make that a little bit more concrete, so the condition then for getting these channel flows where material is moving strongly towards and away from the star, separated by the magnetic forces, would be that the vertical wavelength of the instability is comparable to the density scale height. So, but it's known from shearing box calculations that the strength of the vertical component of the field is like 5 or 6 times less than the total field strength, which is roughly the inverse of 2 pi. So this is roughly like Alphane speed, total Alphane speed should be equal to the sound speed. So that means that our condition for channel flows is beta equals 1. And the active layer almost always contains beta equals 1 because its upper boundary is often set by the condition that beta should be much less than 1. And its lower boundary, I'll show you next, is typically at higher beta.
Maybe you could remind people what the channel flows are because I think some people don't know.
I see, yes. So channel flow is the linear instability that I showed you near the beginning. As it begins to run away, we get strong motions of material. So here, for example. So channel flow means you get one channel of material that's sliding towards the star and one channel that's sliding away from the star. And it's the magnetic forces that are creating that structure. So in between you get a layer where the magnetic field is almost horizontal like this, and up there you get a layer where the magnetic field is almost horizontal like this. If you push this movement to the extreme, so you get material flowing inwards potentially at the sound speed up there and outwards at the sound speed down here. That's the channels. Two channels, one moving in, one moving out. So okay, so where do we get beta of 1 in a typical protostellar disk? So here, what I've done is taken the minimum mass solar nebula and taken the minimum magnetic field that you have to get a T Tauri typical mass flow rate of coupled by 10 to minus 8 solar masses per year. And if you assume that field is then independent of height, then you get the height where the magnetic pressure exceeds the gas pressure. And it's sort of 2 or 3 scale heights at all radii from a tenth of an AU to 100 AU. So then overlay on that the dead zone. So if we have well mixed 1 micron grains at 1% mass fraction. So from this it looks like we can get a channel flow outside the dead zone from about 1 AU on outward. So in here, beta equals 1, we expect these channel flows would just send you diving into the dead zone and you would not expect turbulence or channel flows.
So you don't have the bedroom is supposed to disappear at, like, maybe there are 100 degrees.
Yes, that's
and
right.
You don't consider that at all, important.
Well, it could be important because remember we want to get the crystalline silicates out. So I'll talk a little bit in a minute about how to reach a tenth of an AU or so where things are hot enough to make crystalline grains. So okay, so we've seen that at least outside 1 AU you can get a channel flow. So now let's look at how to carry the dust grains in this channel flow. So here we're going back to the numerical MHD calculations and looking at trajectories of a few test particles inserted into the flow. And so each color is a different particle and we are viewing their paths either along the orbit here or as seen from the star here. And then down the bottom we're looking at their heights as a function of time. And the calculation ran a bit more than 60 orbits. And so notice that particles like the red one that are in the dead zone, the dead zone is the gray band, they move mostly up and down. There's some wiggling up and down, but they don't move much in radius because there's not much angular momentum gained or lost in there. But things up in the turbulent active layers move up and down. They have an irregular zigzag path. And they even, so the blue one, for example, dives down into the dead zone and then comes back up again towards the end. So there is some overshooting of the turbulent motions and there is a bit of exchange of material with the interior. But they only have these erratic motions when they're up in the turbulence. Also notice that the blue particle crosses the domain several times over. So that means that we can use a trick where we count how many times it's been around the domain in the radial direction and then add those together. So we say that this particle has really crossed into the ghost copy of the box, like 2, 3, 4 copies out in radius. So we can say how far it has moved on scales bigger than the box size. It's a trick, so we have to be careful, but it's something that we can do to explore the possible consequences.
So you apply the same shearing boundary condition, periodic condition.
That's right.
So they come back.
That's right. So yeah, when they cross, there's an offset in the azimuthal direction to account for the gradient in orbital speed.
Is it purely a random walk?
Did it change direction actually, or is it just going in the same direction?
We'll see. So here's a whole collection of thousands of the test particles, and they're 1 micron grains, and the gray band is our dead zone again, and here's, for the calculations I'm showing here, the box is 2 scale heights wide in radius, and so this is the radial coordinate. You can see that the particles are evenly mixed in the gas, so there's fewer of them out here where the gas is low density. Now here's what things look like after 2 orbits. So the blue points are the same particles after 2 orbits. And you can see that here's a channel flow. So the gas here, when the particles were put in, happened to be moving towards the star. So this whole cloud of particles has spread out in that direction. Whereas the other side of the channel flow, the side moving away from the star, is down here. And so we get a channel, the other half of the channel, or the other channel. And there's a similar sort of thing happening on the other side. A couple other points to notice. So one thing is that there's a periodic structure here. That's because there are gas density waves passing repeatedly through our box. Because we're making ghost copies of the box out here, each of them has a copy of the density wave. Because the particles are fairly well coupled to the gas, they end up bunching up too. So that's something to be cautious of, that we're repeating a feature that need not be repeated if you look at the disk as a whole. Another thing is these particles down at the midplane, and that's an artifact of me not knowing what to do with particles that left the box, because we had open boundaries. So I just put them in at z equals zero. But notice that they don't stay at z equals zero. They bump around up and down somewhat. And the reason is that there are waves passing through the interior. The turbulence drives oscillations in the dead zone. And so there's a finite width for a layer that otherwise would be infinitesimally thin.
But why do they move radially? They seem to move radially as much as in the channel.
In fact, once they're there, they don't move much radially. So they go up here, they zoom along in radius, they cross the boundary, I drop them down here, and then they stay and jiggle up and down. So now we can go another two orbits, and you can see that many of the particles, so the channel flow is continuing in the same direction. So over several orbits, the channel keeps going constantly, this side going out, this side going in, and similar things down here towards the star, away from the star. And many of the particles have gone a large number of scale heights, 15 scale heights. And if you go about 20 scale heights, you reach the star. So maybe we have significant radial transport here. So here's another way to visualize the same data. So this is just particles in the uppermost scale height of the calculation, that's black, and the lowest scale height of the calculation, between 3 and 4 scale heights below the midplane, in blue. And we're plotting their radial position versus time in orbits. And the yellow band is our domain. So here we've gone to a wider domain, 8 scale heights wide, and still we see the same pattern. Still there's a single channel flow each side of the midplane. And then these dashed lines here are showing the sound speed. That slope is the sound speed. So the particles are zooming towards the star at the sound speed until the channel flow breaks up. So the two sides of the channel, one moving towards and one away, are sliding across each other. So there's a Kelvin-Helmholtz kind of instability, possibly other secondary instabilities. And it breaks up, and things are a bit confused and disordered for a while, and then it starts zooming out. So the black particles now are zooming out, away from the star for a while. So the bottom line is that in just a few orbits, less than 5 orbits, say, we've moved some of the particles all the way to the star. So the red vertical dashed line is showing the location of the star for this particular calculation. So this makes it look almost too easy. I mean, we're moving at least some of the dust particles all the way into the star, which is just what we would need to get them heated up and crystallized.
There's the ones moving at about sound speed, and then there's the boogling, yes, which is from the turbulence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So are you having turbulence in the channel flows, or is it moving from the channel flow into a turbulent region? I mean, I'm trying to understand why a single particle is...
Well, there's some of both. So the channel flow is happening at particular heights, and below it, especially, there is some motion that is not really participating in the channel flow. So these particles are also moving vertically, which is not shown on this plot, of course. So if they happen to dive out of the channel flow, then they'll start just wiggling around more erratically. So it might be possible, for example, to find some way of plotting only the particles that are in the channel flow, and then we would get a cleaner pattern, I think. But this does represent what the particles do as a whole.
So the gas is also in the channel flow. They are also moving at relatively fast in or out.
Yes, that's right. The gas is being mixed too. Gas is flowing at about the sound speed. So, I mean, that also contributes to the occasional breakup of the channel flow that you're capable of forming shocks if there's any kind of disturbance within it. Once you break it up, then the linear instability can set in again, and you'll just produce another channel flow.
Yeah, I think one question that is raised by this is that you assume the coherence of your channel flow, which,
yes,
you have on the scale of h. You assume it's coherent on the scale of 20 h. And if I were to put another box with another initial condition, I'd get these channel flows to collide,
mm-hmm,
and I'd,
yes,
get rid of this potential.
Yes,
so the global picture is probably quite important to understand whether you can really
achieve this. I certainly agree. I mean, so we were experimenting a bit and made the box wider, mm-hmm, and didn't change things, but of course this is still a shearing box, so we're ignoring the convergence of flows towards the star, we're ignoring the hoop stress in the magnetic field as it curves around the star. And so surely some of those things will mean that you can't sustain this flow over an enormous range of radius. But it still seems like you could, if you think of the movements of the particles over the disk surface as a random walk, it's going to have big step lengths. which means you won't need to have very many steps before you can get to the star or far away from it.
Some people also, I'm interested to get in your view, some people challenge the existence of channel flow in the sense that suddenly you see them in sharing box simulations. They are non, as you know from the Goodman and Zhu paper, they are non-linear solutions to the sharing box equations. But some people would argue that if you go to outside of the sharing box, when you break the symmetry, you have some radial profile, then they're no longer from a D solution, non-linear solution even of the equation of motion. So they might disappear altogether. People could claim this. And so it's an issue whether in global simulation you do see channel flows as prominent as in sharing box simulation. Do you have any opinion on this?
Well, so there have been a few global calculations that bear on this, and I haven't seen a careful analysis, but my impression is that they also, when there's zero net flux, they also see that the turbulence can be broken down into a pattern of small channel flows here and there. But I think that still leaves open the issue of how big they can become. To be decided. So let's go back to the kind of schematic global picture. So here, again, is the surface where we estimated beta would be 1 in the minimum mass nebula, creating it coupled by 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. And the red dot is the height where beta equals 1 in our shearing box calculation, which was at 5 AU. And it's higher, and the reason is that instead of having a Gaussian density profile, we have strong magnetic pressure in the disk atmosphere, which supports the gas high up away from the midplane. So beta equals 1 is pushed another scale height, another isothermal scale height or so higher. And that mass flow rate of a couple by 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year is important because it was chosen to match what we had in the MHD calculation, so the mass flow rates agree. So then we can add a line, so the dashed line here is where beta is 1/10 in the minimum mass model, and that roughly agrees with the MHD calculation. So we can think of that as being the height where we expect these channel flows. So then we want to want the channel flows to reach the thermal ionization boundary if we're going to have a hope of taking crystalline grains far outside. So the thermal ionization boundary, you can easily put it at a tenth of an AU, and depending on the mass flow rate, you can maybe push it out to a few tenths of an AU out here somewhere. And then we saw before, this is the dead zone boundary if you have the well-mixed 1 micron grains. And then if you deplete them by 2 and 4 orders of magnitude, which covers the range that's inferred from modeling the mid-infrared colors, continuum colors of T Tauri stars, then you can shift the dead zone boundary down so that the dashed line doesn't reach the edge of the dead zone until it's inside the thermally ionized region, the region that's hot enough to crystallize the grains. So it looks like it's possible for this conveyor belt that we're imagining in the disk surface to go in far enough to bring out the crystals. And another criterion, we can turn that previous plot upside down. So now we're looking at the size of particle that will have its stopping time times the orbital frequency equal to 1 in centimeters on a log scale, so as a function of radius. So, for example, in our MHD calculation, at the height where beta equals 1, particles of about a centimeter, so log of 0, are just supportable by the turbulence at that height. And you can see that for a particle that's moving along this surface all the way into the star, the size of particles that can be supported just increases as you go inward. So if you load this conveyor belt that we're imagining with particles far out here and then just let it move inwards, the particles are not going to drop out of, they're not going to fall off the conveyor. The gas density is increasing, and so you can keep supporting those particles. In fact, could support heavier particles, but they won't stay on the conveyor belt at its outer end. On the other hand, if you load the conveyor at this end and your channel flow is moving outwards, then the bigger particles are going to drop off as you move outwards, and by the time you get far out, they'll only be little things. So it seems, but even though you probably have to have particles that are much smaller than this threshold, still it's certain that you can get micron-sized crystalline grains way out, because this is a millimeter still out here at 10 AU or so. So you can certainly get small grains far out by carrying them in the surface layers through this process.
So how do you envision getting this stuff out again? So you bring it in, you right away you flash it or whatever, and you get the composition. And how does it get back out?
Well, the channel flows reverse every so often. So in this picture, for example, we had say look at these blue ones here, for example. They zoomed in towards the star. They had a period when they were jiggling around, and they go zooming back out again here. So if this is the hot side, they went in, they got heated, and then they came back out. So the conveyor belt moves material both directions.
So the same location when you're looking up at some height at on the disk, yep. You're going sometimes back and forth between having inflow and outflow?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's erratic and random, but the throw with each resetting is quite far. Certainly bigger than 8 scale heights, which we have here. So my suggestion is that the MRI makes a kind of a conveyor belt on the disk surface, and it carries stuff in. Some of it gets dumped out, but some of it gets heated and carried back out away from the star. So that's it. So I've been thinking a little bit about how we might test this. I mean, one possibility is variability. So there are examples where the 10 micron feature changes and even goes from absorption to emission over times of a year or something like that. And that's the sort of thing that could potentially be explained by this. We're able to move material from one place to another.
Is that the right time scale?
It is if you're considering material close to the star.
Can you quantify how much material
you
will transport?
Not yet. I mean, one way to do that might be to take some kind of guess about the structure of the flow on the global scale and run test particles through that and see how many of them make it. Because, of course, some will be dropped into the dead zone and won't be able to come back, and so they'll be lost. So, and on the other hand, we don't know the source far out in the disk. So, I mean, we have to make some assumption about what we have going onto the conveyor belt at the outside edge, but at least maybe we can derive probabilities. If you put it on one location, how likely is it to make it somewhere else?
So this seems like a right thing to explain CAI-like particles, but that it's very unclear to me that you could do anything about the chondrules, for example. So you would have to have a separate mechanism that would form the chondrules.
Yes, I think so. The sizes that you can carry, at least locally in the turbulence, are in the chondrule range. I mean, the chondrules are sort of in this size range, and they're in the meteorite belt, so I guess about here in radius. But I suspect that in order to carry things very far, we'll have to be well below this threshold for carrying things in the turbulence.
I'm also worried about the heating, because with CAIs, you can take a little heat for a very long time, where the chondrules seem like maybe more of a flash melt.
Yes.
Flash melt here being, you know, minutes to hours.
Yes, that would be difficult to do in this picture. Such a short time scale.
Jay, you said that you use primarily zero flux boundary conditions.
And you said something about you had a little bit of non-zero flux.
Could you just give us one more bit of detail? In other words, when you make a disk, you expect to drag in some fields from the outside, so you don't expect pure zero flux, right?
Yes.
So how much field can you drag in and still not change your picture? And if you drag in a lot of field, what will happen to this picture? just qualitatively, right?
The more field you drag in, the further you'll push the beta equals one surface away from the midplane. And if you push it up very high, then it'll meet the surface where ambipolar diffusion starts to be important, apart from the midplane, and then you shouldn't expect much or any magnetic activity. You shouldn't expect any accretion flow. But until you get to that point, I think you'll still have a channel. Certainly, you'll still have a layer where beta equals one that's inside the active layer.
But will that be higher, so you get less mass moving back and forth?
Yes, that's true. There'll be less mass, and also from this, the particle size range might be constricted.
Mm. Are your deltons realistic in the sense of ratio of delta to dead column to active column in mass, and then even scale height? Because from what I remember, many of the simulations that have been done tend not to. Because the active zones are very small physically. Even Hilbert's personal expertise is very small physically. So effectively, it's very hard to resolve numerically, and people tend to trade and have a relatively thin dead zone. And that would make the active zones thicker. Is that the case also in the simulation?
I have tried to make the active layer realistic in the sense that I've calculated the ionization recombination chemistry along with the MHD. So that one reason for pushing out to 5 AU is that there the column is only 100 or 200 grams per square centimeter, so our 10 grams per square centimeter of active material is a significant fraction of the total. If I did this at 1 AU, then I would face the problem that you mentioned.
And you hope to do that in a global simulation, or it's hopeless?
It's possible if you don't try to be too ambitious in terms of the range of radii that you cover. So I'm working with Natalia Zerkovich and some other people in Heidelberg who are doing global MHD calculations with resistivity, with a fixed resistivity profile so far. And if you stay away from that region where the column density is very high, then you can get reasonable results. So one finding so far, for example, is that if you take a patch the same size as your shearing box out of the global calculation, the time variations in the magnetic stress look pretty similar and have a similar relation to the magnetic flux that happens to be piercing that patch at that time. So it doesn't suggest any drastic changes from what we're seeing in the local calculations.
So there are global calculations with fixed resistivity?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, just very new.
Just starting new.
So do they see channel flows?
So far they're with either zero net flux or with a toroidal field. And they also only go up. So the other limitation that you have with the global calculations is you can't let the time step get too small. And so they only go up to two or a bit more than two scale heights either side of the midplane. And then in many of them they use periodic boundaries from there. So what leaves in this direction reappears on the other side of the disk. So they don't go far enough up so that they would expect to see channel flows of the kind that I'm talking about here. But within the turbulence that they do see, down at a couple scale heights, the pattern of individual small channel flows making up part of the turbulence is similar to what you get at that height in the shearing box calculations. So, but again, that doesn't really answer the question of what's going to happen when you go far enough up so that the expected size of the channel flow will become comparable to the radial scales that the global calculation is allowing variation.
All right, any more questions?
Thank you.